Week on Today Now, and we're highlighting individuals and companies who are helping the environment.
And one of those companies is Taco Bell. Starting this week, Taco Bell restaurants are going 100% green. Now, they're going to have the same menu items that you've come to know and love, but none of the ingredients are taken from nature.
And that means zero environmental impact. So joining us now live is Paul Lancaster, spokesman from Taco Bell. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Tracy.
Now, Paul, nothing on Taco Bell's new menu uses anything that came from nature.
Not a single ingredient. Starting this week, all of the ingredients that we use are going to be produced in labs by special Taco Bell food synthesizers.
Wow, and it tastes the same as before, Paul.
You can't even tell the difference.
Oh, the lettuce looks so realistic.
Now, how hard was it to make the leap into the eco-friendly menu?
Well, at Taco Bell, we have a long tradition of taking as little as possible from the natural world.
Right.
Our ground beef, for example, has always been fairly eco-friendly. It's 85% gluten filler, 8% petroleum-based grease flavoring, but it's always had 4% meat.
Well, that's bad
from real livestock. Well, exactly right. But with Taco Bell's new green initiative, we've actually been able to replace that 4% meat with a simple chemical adhesive.
So you're not wasting food or water to feed the cattle.
That's right.
And because you're using no natural ingredients whatsoever anymore, I understand you're able to add something that you're calling Super Green Supreme menu items that you never would have been able to do before.
Yes. At Taco Bell, Jim, we are changing the definition of food. Starting next month, we're introducing the Ultimate Grande Crunchador, which is jam-packed with chunks of an ingredient that has no equivalent in the natural world.
Wow, that does look
We also
filling.
Have a new chalupa.
Yes.
Which removes the carbon dioxide and pollution from the air around it so that it helps reduce global warming.
Look at that. So we're eating at Taco Bell, we're cleaning the earth.
That's right.
Wow.
Amazing.
What are these science guys going to think
Amazing.
Up next? Huh?
Also, in 3 years, we're planning to start melting down all of the lids, the straws, and the wrappers that the food comes in and recycle it into new Taco Bell foods. You will actually be eating the garbage you produce.
Isn't that something? Oh. That's quite an inspiration.
Yes. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Listen, don't go away, because when we come back, we're going to show you how to save money by writing your own books.
Hey, what's happening? Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. I get the sense that the staff at The Onion, the writers, everybody who works there, I think they just get it. That intro from The Onion is not the first time I've shared that with you. I mean, I've shared a lot of them with you. And there's a lot on their site that deal with food that I haven't even, you know, told you about. I mean, they're funny, but they hit the mark every time, you know, in regards to how silly it's become. And I've got to hand it to them. It's maybe the best comedy on the internet and makes the most sense. TheOnion.com. I'm going to be peppering this episode with clips from the documentary King Korn, which is a couple of years old now, but I thought it was important that we don't forget exactly how important that movie was, especially coming on the heels of Food Inc. When King Korn was just, you know, rounding up, starting to get into theaters, I was trying to promote it as much as I could here, and a lot of you saw it, and they showed it on PBS for free, which, you know, makes it really easy, but it is available at Blockbuster for rent, or you can buy it at kingkorn.net. Check it out. It's a great movie, and it hits on so many of the same types of topics, in particular, which the clips that I'm pulling from are mainly about, that by eating fast food burgers, we're basically promoting the growth of the same trap that we've fallen into for a long time. We're in love with really cheap food. So the farmers are raising cattle by confining them and feeding them mostly corn, because it's the most economical. This is bad for the cows. It gets them sick. But luckily enough, they grow so big so quickly that we kill them before the sickness manages to kill them. So you may remember this clip. I played this when King Korn first opened, and I was trying to promote the film for them.
What are you eating for lunch here today?
Corn-fed beef. Do you actually know anything about corn-fed beef? You know what it does to them?
What is
it? To the cattle. It's a good thing they slaughter when they do, because it actually kills them to feed them to make the meat like that. So they'd be dead in 6 months anyway eating that stuff, so it's just as well that they slaughter.
Really?
Yeah, it's terrible.
Where is this?
Every major confinement feedlot, everywhere.
We're eating sick animals, and I just as soon promote the end of eating beef than to continue to support companies like McDonald's, who drive the big machine. Now, as one of the farmers in the clip says, and I'll play this later, if America demanded grass-fed beef, they'd grow grass-fed beef. It would cost them more to grow it. It would cost us more. But they would do it. And, the problem is that we want cheap food. So the only way to make it cheap is to grow them quick by feeding them corn and then slaughtering them young. Robert Kenner, while he was promoting Food Inc., he brought up a really good point. He said in the 60s, American families spent around 18% of their annual income on food. Now, you know how much we spend on food now? Around 8%. It's really low. And I think 8% might be even high. In the 1960s, we spent 6% of our annual income on health care and hospital visits. Do you know how much we spend now? 17%. It seems really strange that it's upside down like that. Doesn't it? And this leads us down the same path here. I've said it before as well. We're stuck now. Because your options are not good. Either spend more money on grass-fed beef, meaning you'll have to eat less than you do now because of the additional cost. And let's be fair here. Nobody has an extravagant budget right now. So that's not really a viable option. Or we continue to eat the grain-fed beef and further the loop, or we give up eating beef altogether, which is exactly what PETA would love to happen. So I don't really have an answer. I guess, eat grass-fed when you can, and you can manage it in your budget, and try to avoid fast food burgers when at all possible, I guess. I don't know. It's the best I can do. It just kind of sucks. But seriously, giving up on beef, if we can't afford the good stuff, is the only way we're going to close shop on the bad stuff. It's something that everybody has to do, not just us. And that's what makes it frustrating. We're chasing our tail. It's really a personal decision. Does it mean that much to you? It doesn't mean that much to your kids. So either we stop giving the big machine our money or we just kill ourselves. The 20-something generation is the first generation who are not forecasted to outlive their parents in regards to age because of the food intake. Higher rates of onset diabetes, heart disease, tons of other issues. And their kids won't outlive them unless we start making a change right now. It's just something to think about. Just need to start eating better. And I had intended on playing these clips anyway, but I got into this big discussion with Jennifer Litz of Food Bites and Blogging for Business. She was working on a story about beef that are fed beer, and to her knowledge, only Kobe in Japan are fed beer, as well as sake. And that led to a question of whether or not Kobe beef was actually available in the U.S. As it turns out, due to her research and the help of Carrie Oliver at Oliver Ranch, it is available in the U.S. now, as it turns out. There's no ban, apparently. But it's really difficult to find, and you will pay through the nose if you do manage to find it. And then you've got a question, is it actually worth it or not? Because from what I've been told, it's not. Really good American grass-fed beef is actually better. Anyway, more on this as we go along. It kind of seems to be a theme along with this food entertainment thing. There are tons of food shows on television right now. Concurrently, we have Top Chef Masters, The F Word, No Reservations, and The Next Food Network Star. Top Chef Masters is on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. on Bravo. It's a great idea. They're really talented chefs, far better food on this show than on the regular Top Chef. They're pitting professional chefs against each other, and they're giving them the same kind of challenges that they use on Top Chef. But I don't know what it is about this show that makes it boring. But at least in the early rounds, it has been an absolute snore fest after the final challenge is complete. The judges' table is really boring. And by the time they get to a winner, you really don't even give a shit who wins. You just want it to end so you can see who's going to be on next week. But the best part about Top Chef Masters is that this French chef, who I've never heard of before, Chef Ludo, he's on it, third show, I think. And it's just it's a hot mess. And he doesn't win, but he's really entertaining. He's funny as hell, curses like a drunken sailor. And he's one of these badass chefs with tons of tattoos, a really filthy mouth. Looks kind of like he rides a bike on weekends. I mean, a bike like a chopper. But like a lot of the chefs that are in this competition, I didn't know who the hell he was. And then Joe and Charles, who are members of our LA food blogger posse that we have now, they go to this dinner together at this thing called Ludo Bites. And Joe posts on her site, mylastbite.com, and I see the pictures, and I recognize this dude. I said, who is he? You know, he looks familiar. And I realized, oh, shit, that's him. So I think if there's anything good about Top Chef Masters, at least right now, for me anyway, because Kelly Choi is just ruining it, to be honest. For me anyway, if anything comes out of this, I'm learning names of some of the most talented chefs in the U.S. I mean, they've got real talent on this show. And they give them challenging things to cook that I'm not sure regular Top Chef contestants could actually pull off, let alone, you know, pull off well. I mean, these are professional chefs, and they perform absolute miracles every week. And you're watching the All-Star Game every time it's on.
When Kelly unveiled the first one, it was a heart. I thought, oh, cool, awful. Awful is all the parts, you know, the interesting parts. Brains, spleen, liver, kidneys, testicles.
We're going to be trying to convince people to eat things that most Americans say are not edible.
Rick.
That's tongue. We actually love to eat tongue.
Cindy. Let's see what you have.
I've got tripe. My protein was tripe, which is stomach.
Ludo, you have? Pig's ears for you.
Better him than me, because I've never cooked a pig ear in my life. I don't know how to do it.
I like it. I use that in France. If you want to be the master, you need to know about food. I know to cook a pig ear. I know to cook the tripe, the tongue, the heart. I know all these things. We don't do street food in France. I say, what am I going to do? And I was thinking, you know what? Quesadilla. Do a quesadilla. Everybody loves quesadilla.
When I heard that Ludo was going to be doing a quesadilla, I thought, oh, bad choice, bad choice.
The one that you would do would be like
it's a French guy, you know about a quesadilla.
You are the expert on that.
So Joe and Charles ate there, and I guess Ludo Bites now is Joe's new bazaar. I mean, she's there all the time. And this guy, Chef Ludo, he sets up shop in other people's restaurants. This is the gig. You know, restaurants that normally don't do dinner, he sets up there for like a month or a week or however long it is, and he serves these incredible dishes and really good food, fresh, unique, and its own spin on everything. And it's obviously spectacular. And best of all, recently I got to meet Charles from 100 Miles at Joe and Peter's house. They had this garden party, and we all went there. We drank some wine, talked all night. Charles is fantastic. He's an ex-chef, cooked in a number of restaurants for years, and he's got a really good blog, 100miles.blogspot.com. Here's how it's spelled. The number one, 100miles.blogspot.com. It's all about the idea of eating within 100 miles of home. And being a locavore is really tough in any place. Even if you live in an ag area, it's tough. Try it in Los Angeles. I mean, Charles has great stories to share, and it's always a pleasure to read new things from him, really, because he writes really well, and it's approachable food writing. And it's really one of my favorite blogs, 100miles.blogspot.com. It's a number one, and then 100 miles. So Gordon Ramsay's The F Word is in its fourth season, and it's just as good, if not better, than it was in previous seasons. And that shows on BBC America on Wednesdays. And what I really like about The F Word, as we've talked about that quite a bit here, is that they continue to concentrate on farming. Fresh food, getting people out of the rut of eating the same things, or just eating out a lot. And I'm also noticing that they drop less F-bombs than they have in previous seasons, because it does get a little distracting when you have to hear bleeps every 15 seconds. So I pulled some audio from it so you can hear, and you'll notice it's a lot easier to listen to now that they don't curse.
Welcome to The F Word, the best food in town. For the next 3 months, I've got families cooking in my kitchen.
These guys aren't fueling their body with the right food. They've got no chance of getting through a day's training, let alone 32 f***ing weeks. What are you eating?
Breakfast, sausage and beans.
Sausage and beans.
Very nice.
Oh, f*** me, look at that. It's like inside a f***ing nappy. Holy crap. Have you ever been out, looked at the rations and just said, f*** that, I'm not eating that?
Yes.
I can think of the indigestion, eating all those f***ing rations. So ginger's a welcome spice. I'm going to do Tarzan next time. I'm going to give you a f***ing run for your money.
I'm just gradually like, you know, f*** it, you know what I mean? Tonight I'm going to f***ing shave it off and f***ing roast it.
Nicole said she'd done it with a frying pan. A bit like a pudding bowl, but a flat one.
What, my haircut with
a
frying
pan? Yeah, she didn't cut that, did she?
You cut f***ing yours. You look like you've been electrocuted, you f***er. You've been struck by lightning.
Okay. The new season of No Reservations is also underway. Mondays at 7 on the Travel Channel. And by new, I don't mean new. It's the second half of season 5. And it's interesting how it's done. And if you read Bourdain's blog, which you should, he describes the process. They go and they travel to like 16 different areas and locations. Then they come back and they edit those. They do post-production voiceovers, music, and when they have 8 of them in the can, then they'll start showing them. And while you're seeing those, there's another 8 that are being edited and in post-production. So it takes a long time to get these things out. And they just get better and better and better with each episode. The way it's edited and shot and put together, it's a lot like a documentary. And they shoot some of the best B-roll in the business, I think. And best of all, No Reservations has now been nominated for 3 Emmy Awards, including Outstanding Nonfiction Series. I think that's great. I mean, there's something you would not have seen had he stayed on the Food Network. Because it's grown a lot in over the course of the show. And it's a show about food from other cultures. It's not really a cooking show. You know, it's just a show about food. And something else, his show is a lot more serious than other food shows.
It's 12 hot inches of throbbing meat in tube form. Oh my God, holy Jeebus. Whoa, hombre, that is 12 freaking inches of floppy clown shoe right there. The origins of this all-beef Wonder Wiener remain shrouded in mystery. And what of the name, Completo? What makes it complete?
Basically a big hot dog in a big bun, right? Then, see, he puts chucrut,
sauerkraut.
The pickles, the pickle vegetables, chopped pickle vegetables, tomato.
But I have a pound of guacamole.
And it all gets topped off with a copious, some might say excessive, slathering of mayo.
Oh my God, it's enormous.
What does one say to a terrifying Ron Jeremy-esque tube of meat like this, adrift on a sea of avocado and mayo? I don't know whether to eat this thing or conceal it in a brown paper bag. I feel like Tara Patrick mid-shift.
So last but not least, of course, is the next Food Network star, which I believe now is in its 5th or 6th season. Yeah, so my Dodgers are doing pretty good, huh? Really, had a good first half. We got the best record in the majors. Could be going to the playoffs. Really doing great.
For anyone who's eaten a delicious piece of fresh tuna sashimi, it's hard to imagine a seafood menu without tuna on it. But that might be our future if we don't take action. Scientists warn we are running a very real risk of depleting the ocean's tuna thanks to overfishing. We arrive at the dock of a small tuna factory in Manado, Indonesia, just as this fishing boat is unloading its yellowfin catch. They use a single line. Conservationists say it's the most sustainable fishing method. We're still finding the fish, the boat's captain says, but some years we have to go farther out to get it. The fish are also smaller. Though it takes at least 2 men to heave around, each is about half the weight it should be.
This is how your sushi and sashimi start out. The first stage is cleaning the fish. Sanitation here is key. This small factory produces around 2,000 tons of fresh tuna a year, exporting it to the Japanese and U.S. markets.
Unlike these fish, most tuna are caught using net or longline fishing, techniques that bring in massive amounts of tuna but drain the population.
We pretty much worry about overfishing. Of course, everybody have to sit down, I think. Not only our problem. This is international. Every country, stakeholder, have to sit together.
Scientists warn we have to take action now. According to the WWF, we've already managed to fish out 90% of the world's large fish, and 40% of the world's recorded catch is wasted. as in caught in nets and not consumed. As Dr. Lita Petsode of the WWF says, it's not just about saving the fish.
If we don't address overfishing for some of the species, and tuna is very critically overfished, then there will be no jobs, there will be no food going to Europe and the United States and Japan, and also the food security for people living here is going to be really a problem.
At stake is the livelihood of millions of people, the loss of a major source of protein for hundreds of millions, and the collapse of a multi-billion dollar industry. In Japan's Tsukiji fish market, bluefin tuna prices are off the charts. In January, one sold at an auction for just over $100,000. The financial incentive to hunt down to the very last bluefin tuna is huge. But if we keep hauling fish out of the waters at this rate, we're going to find ourselves with a vast ocean and very little to eat from it, as the last tuna is carted away to the highest bidder.
That's a great report from CNN. They've been threatening to outlaw sport fishing off of our coast for a really long time, and I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't happen soon. Because this isn't all hype, even though, you know, I know CNN gets accused of spouting propaganda all the time. Now, this is real. I mean, this is something that's been pending for a long time. We've got a lot of mouths to feed, but I think more importantly is, why do they let them continue to fish with nets? I mean, that is a ton of waste. But sooner or later, it's just going to be a tuna-less world. And let me tell you something. I don't want to tell you how upset my cat, Clark, is going to be when there's no tuna available. I mean, if anything, you got to think about my cat. You want to talk about a pissed-off tabby? It's going to be Palmageddon.
Yes, it's cool to look out there at all those cattle and feel warm and fuzzy that I'm feeding a lot of American people. Our operation is that we buy calves and we bring them into the feedlot and feed them for 140, 150 days here and then sell them to the packing plant as fed cattle. Basically, 14 to 16,000 head are finished here. We don't like being big, but right now you're looking at a family farm in Yuma County, Colorado. If the American people wanted strictly grass-fed beef, we would produce grass-fed beef for them. But it's definitely more expensive. And one of the tenets in America is America wants and demands cheap food.
Got a lot of new listeners to the show. I want to welcome them. I've been trying to write more this year. So in between shows, I've been posting articles about subjects that I'm interested in. And one happened to be on vegan longaniza, which is a chorizo from the Philippines. And that post got quite a few comments, including one from Mila, who said she's now a fan for life. Fan for life! How many other podcasts can say they have a fan for life? I mean, you know, my wife's a fan for life, but she doesn't have a choice. She's stuck with me. So thanks to Mila for that awesome comment. The funny thing is, and I've heard this before, she said she listens up to my podcast while she's walking down the street to her office, I think in New York, and she'll start laughing. And then she'll get weird looks from people like, you know, what are you laughing at? I think that's great. First of all, I think it's great that someone finds the show funny besides me. The thing is, it's happened to me before on an airplane when I was listening to something, and it was kind of embarrassing. Although with me, you know, I end up talking back, and I don't realize I'm doing it. Like, I talk to the TV all the time. I mean, I can't stop talking. Anyway, it just gets weirder looks, because then they're like, who are you talking to? I also want to welcome Steve, who also commented on the soybean post. Steve's one of these guys, one of these people who realizes they're a foodie, but they don't want to call themselves a foodie because they're not sure that they've gotten there yet. I think if you're really obsessed with food and you talk about it a lot, you think about it a lot, and if you wake up thinking about it and you think about calling yourself a foodie, you're pretty much a foodie. I mean, if you discover a food podcast and you start listening to it from episode 1 through 40 and can put up with 30 plus hours of an annoying wannabe radio guy spewing his disdain for the Food Network and fast food monopolies and, you know, love for farmers and growers, I think if you can actually put yourself through all of that and then ask for more, then yeah, I think you're well on your way. So thanks, Steve. You're a foodie, all right? Thanks for listening and for your comments. It's really nice to read that stuff. It's always good to know that people are listening to your show. So otherwise, I'd just be here by myself. I'd probably still be doing it in the sane asylum.
The mass production of corn drives the mass production of animal protein in confined operations. And you got to have cheap feed to do the confinements.
That's my brand. I just sold these to the feedlot in March. I really don't have many other alternatives.
At Sue Jarrett's cow-calf operation, we saw how cattle are raised before they go to the feedlot, eating grass on the open range. When Sue's father ran the ranch, cattle spent almost all their lives eating grass, and it took several years to reach market weight. But in recent years, cattle have begun spending more and more of their lives in feedlots.
They put on weight faster if you don't let them move. So total confinement, less space for movement. They eat continually, and you get them into the market, into the food chain. But cattle were not meant to be on a corn-fed diet for that long. You know, we used to feed them 60, 90 days was one thing. Up to 120, you could make it. You start really pushing cattle on a corn-based diet after that, the ulcers and the stomachs don't take it well, and they start getting sick.
Yeah, so Jennifer at Food Bites, who I'm telling you now, start reading her. She's one of the best writers I've seen come down the pipe in a long time. And not just a good food writer, a good writer, period. I mean, among all writers. Anyway, she sent me this email, had a link to this website, foodanimalconcerns.org. Yeah, it's for fact, Food Animal Concerns Trust. Their vision is that one day all farms will be humane and healthy places to raise food animals. And their mission is to improve the welfare of food-producing animals. They seek to broaden opportunities for humane farmers and address the public health problems that come from the production of meat, milk, and eggs. I definitely think this is a genuine concern because I've said so many times before, you have to respect these animals while they're alive because it's going into your body. And by disrespecting the ingredients, you disrespect yourself. I mean, does that make sense? Because people still say, you know, I don't get it. You say you're respecting the animal, but then you kill it. Yeah, we have to kill it, but, you know, it's done humanely. There's no reason to kill it inhumanely, is there? I mean, is there such a thing as a humane kill versus an inhumane kill? You know, that's the question I get. We've done this before. You know, we had a whole show about it. We played that stuff from the F word, the arbitrage. And, you know, I don't want to explain it 100 times. Go eat your tofu burger and shut the hell up. I mean, I get tired of having to explain this over and over. There is a difference. Go back and listen. But the other thing that I do struggle with is that, you know, Jennifer brought up this. She said she finds it funny when foodies talk about humanely raising animals and treating them with respect. Then we turn around and support the farming of foie gras. When, what about the geese? I think that's a good argument, but, you know, you watch the farmers doing it right, and we've done this before on the show. Remember we had the foie gras battle between Bourdain and Agent 007? There's the right way of doing it and the wrong way of doing it, and farmers in general will do it humanely. You're not hurting their throats with the funnels, and they're eating a ton of food, yeah, but, you know, it's what we call fat and happy. And again, I don't have an argument other than to say the geese are not walking around with sores all over their bodies, being kicked in the face, being treated poorly, like a lot of livestock, chicken, and pigs are in the large commercial farms. I mean, this is night and day.
100 years ago, most cattle probably were fed grass, hay, and they were out grazing. We've gone from really feeding no grain to rations now that contain up to 90% grain. But these animals evolved not in feeding these high starch or things like corn. You feed a lot of corn, more acid's produced, and the animal can get into trouble. Corn in this environment produces these acids, the pH drops, and then they succumb to a condition we call acidosis. And if it's not treated, the animal dies.
The corn fed to cattle is supplemented with low doses of antibiotics that help them combat acidosis. Livestock now consumes 70% of the antibiotics in the United States. But antibiotics also help cattle survive the conditions of confinement. This facility, with more than 100,000 head of cattle, produces as much waste as a city of 1.7 million people.
Hey, you know, as long as we're talking about television food shows, season 6 of Top Chef debuts on August 26th on Bravo, this time from Las Vegas. And I really love that Bravo realizes where their bread is buttered. Because by treating us to a filler show like Top Chef Masters in between seasons 5 and 6, and when I say filler, I mean, I don't mean it in a negative way. Like, they're giving us something else to eat between seasons. And in some ways, in regards to the caliber of food that they're cooking on Top Chef Masters, regular Top Chef just can't compete with that. I mean, no offense to the top chefs, but please, you know, Hubert Keller? Come on. Anyway, the new season, which is the last one before Padma rides off into the sunset with Carl's Jr., and the sitcom. Did I talk about this yet? I didn't. This is it for Padma. She's leaving Top Chef. Some NBC executive, obviously couldn't keep it in his pants, gave Padma a nod to develop a sitcom about God knows what. And listen, I love Padma. Don't get me wrong. I know I break balls here a lot. Padma's awesome, and she's perfect for Top Chef. In fact, she makes Top Chef for me. She's pretty. She's intelligent. She, you know, she makes really good, solid comments. She's got great legs, beautiful set of lungs. And she's, you know, she's great for the show. But listen, she's kind of low-key on Top Chef. You know, she's really low-key. And she's cute, but who the hell thinks that low-key attitude of hers is going to translate in a sitcom? I mean, seriously, you have to have some really good writing to make that work. I thought the only thing that I could possibly imagine as a storyline that they could write about and make it funny and interesting is if they had Salman Rushdie suddenly come back to her, you know, and he needs help. You know who Salman Rushdie is, right? He's that big, fat writer dude. I mean, he's old. He's got a big beard. I think he's Indian. And he wrote this book called The Satanic Verses, and it pissed off the Shah of Iran so bad that he put a price on his head. He wanted him dead, and I think it was blasphemous or something. I never read the book, but there was a big story. So he went into hiding. So she married him. That was like her first husband, and she was obviously the trophy wife in that situation, if you know what I'm talking about. Anyway, so the idea of this show would be he comes to her, right? He needs a place to stay because he's being followed by Al-Qaeda or Iran or whoever it is, put the price on his head. So she has to help him by hiding him in her apartment, but she doesn't want him to live there because, you know, she's trying to, like, live her life. So here's the deal. Every week, she's got to think of healthy meals to cook for him because he's, like, 300 pounds. He's disgusting. He's nasty beard. He smells. And she's got this mission to get him down to, like, 150 pounds. So she can kick him out. Al-Qaeda won't notice him when she finally, you know, kicks his smelly ass out of her apartment. So each week she's making these healthy dishes for him. And he's bitching and complaining because he wants, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken or some other nasty shit, whatever he eats. And she's tormenting him with, like, raw diets. She makes him take fiber supplements. She makes him sleep on the terrace because he smells. And meanwhile, she's sneaking out to Carl's Jr. She's having that triple stack or whatever that burger is, that juicy sauce. I think that would be fantastic. We call it Bum Rushdie and Me. Because, you know, she's trying to bum rush him out of her house. Yeah, anyway, we're being treated in season 6 of Top Chef to really good guest judges. Natalie Portman, Penn and Teller, Wolfgang Puck, Todd English, Daniel Ballude, Tyler Florence, Laurent Torrendell, and Nigella Lawson. Nigella. Yeah, but listen, this season of Top Chef, which is going to be really extra special for me for the show, because, and I can finally share this secret with you now, one of the contestants is none other than Michael Voltaggio. He's the chef de cuisine at Bazaar. You remember me talking to you about Michael, right? That night we were at the Bazaar. He came to our table. He shook our hands, treated us like VIPs because we were with Peter and Joe, who are VIPs. He led Dean into the kitchen to finish plating a dish. And the Bazaar is home to Marcel, who was runner-up in season 2. So the Bazaar is kind of racking up the top chefs, you know? And there are actually 2 Jose Andreas chefs in Top Chef this time. Because there's also Michael Isabella, who's the executive chef at Jose Andreas Greek Mediterranean restaurant, Zaytinya, in Washington, D.C. So if you get a chance, go to bravotv.com. Look at the bios for this lineup of chefs. You tell me if this doesn't look like the hairiest bunch of badass chefs you've ever seen on this show. I mean, it looks like there's going to be more than just cooking competition. We're going to have fist fights, you know, knife fights. It's going to be nasty. And there's lots of serious egos up in this season, seriously. And I can't wait to see what they bring. Of course, you know, I'm going to be in Voltaggio's corner. I mean, I'm rooting for Michael all the way through. However far he gets, no matter if he pulls major dick moves or not, you know, because if he does, I'm sure they were warranted. So, go Michael.
The meat that we eat in this day and age is produced in a feedlot. It's grain-fed meat. And we produce a characteristically obese animal, an animal whose muscle tissue looks more like fat tissue than it does lean meat in wild animals. And if you look at a T-bone steak from a grain-fed cow, it may have as much as 9 grams of saturated fat, whereas a comparable steak from a grass-fed animal would have 1.3 grams of saturated fat.
Oh, and to stick with the entertainment topic, let's not forget Julie and Julia, starring Meryl Streep and Amy Adams. It's a chick flick, but it's a good flick. It opens wide August 7th, and it follows Julia Child's life in France, while telling a story of a food blogger who decides to make all of her dishes from her book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking. So it looks good. It'll probably make you want to go home and cook after you watch it. And as I've said in the past, if you go to a Nora Ephron flick with your wife or your girlfriend, you get free sex that night. It's the law. And I'm sure you're all tired of me shoving King Corn down your throats for the last half hour, or however long it's been. So I'm going to tell you, I'm going to leave now, but I highly advise you order a copy of King Corn on DVD. Go to kingcorn.net or rent it from Blockbuster, whoever has it. It's an important movie for everybody who tunes into the show to watch. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for listening, for commenting. And again, you really don't know how much it means to get feedback. You know, sometimes we just don't know who's listening, and it's good to hear that my voice isn't falling on deaf ears. Special thanks to TheOnion.com and CNN for the audio and music in this episode from The Prodigy. If you like the song, download it in the iTunes Store, 99 cents. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie, and I'll see you guys next time.